Hello. Good afternoon. Slan Javan, welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, coming to you from the Hertz Bunker at a super secret location in beautiful Guelph, Ontario, Canada. And joining me from the selfsame city on the Skype line is Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, is the Guelph Politico of the End Credit Show on the station and also the co-host of this show. Adam, how are you today?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. It's a little chilly even here in my bunker, which is overlooking the beautiful Hanlon Expressway.
Oh, right. Well, we'll see if we can have a little bit of a fundraiser and get you some heat or one of those little microfurnace heaters or something. They're all the rage.
No, that's all right. I have one of those like Bunsen burners. That's pretty safe, right?
Yes.
That's pretty safe.
As long as you got the smoke detector tuned up. Anyway, today on the program, in the second part at 5:30, we have an interview with Graham McNaughton of the Guelph Mercury Tribune. Adam spoke to him earlier regarding a story that he was breaking or helping to break regarding China forced labor and the Canadian connections to that. But before that, we're going to discuss QAnon. Is QAnon gone? No one's really sure, especially QAnon people, now that their savior is golfing or whatever the heck he's doing. That's been awful quiet, and we'll discuss that a bit as well, I have no doubt. But off the top, Adam, of course, the hottest political story, which we, even though it's getting a ton of coverage, we absolutely have to discuss, and that is the situation in Ottawa with Julie Payette, and now Canada is Governor General-less. Is that even grammatical? I don't even know if that's grammatically correct. Rather than face the music directly, she stepped down after a report was released.
Last week.
Yeah, this is all very, very fresh and rapid. Report released last week that said that there was some problems, some difficulty in the workplace. And it sort of leaked out over the course of the week, or was presented over the course of the week, how bad that was. I believe the number of people that they spoke to was, there's 95 on the list, but 43 mm-hmm. of them had, so at least half of them, and this is former and current employees, described a workplace that was hostile and negative, just painful things coming at us. And it sounds like that was the case from day one, both with Payette and her her friend and who became her assistant, Assunta Di Lorenzo. There's a patronage appointment, if you've ever heard of one. So, Adam, what have you been? Haven't really been near the socials or anything today. What's the latest?
Well, the latest was last night when CTV News said that they had gotten their hands on the redacted report through a Freedom of Information request. It is almost, actually, no, it is 132 pages long. So it is quite the comprehensive report. And like you said, it's, you know, 95 people interviewed. And it was kind of like over the course of a month. Like this was like recently, too. It was like October 19th to November 23rd is when they did all these interviews. And then the report is finished like this time last week. And to be clear, the report hasn't been formally released. What we have comes from leaks, and what CTV reported on, that they've seen the redacted report, which isn't even the full report. It was so bad, and you knew it was so bad. Just the mere fact of its existence forced Justin Trudeau to walk across the yard and say, like,
yell over the fence.
Like, no, you're like, this is it. Although from what I gather, she didn't actually live in Rideau Hall. She was living elsewhere. It just, you know, some of the things in it that knowledgeable individuals, only 10 of whom that they interviewed said that they had either positive for neutral reactions to their time working with Julie Payette. So like 10, so like 1 out of 10 people said, you know what, I had a good experience, or I had like no feelings about the experience at all, which isn't great. The phrase climate or reign of fear and or terror was used repeatedly. Toxic workplace, yelling, screaming, aggressive conduct, public humiliation. I mean, these are all things that you would expect to hear out of working in the Weinstein offices. They're not expecting out of coming out of Rideau Hall, but this is the this is apparently the environment that the now former Governor General created. And on top of it all, you know, you don't have to look too far back in her history. She left the Montreal Science Center under dubious circumstances, accusations she'd created a hostile workplace there. And I mean, it all comes down to the fact that she was kind of the hands-on pick of Trudeau. And there was none of the usual vetting. And I mean, at the end of the day, the Harper government created this process, this selection process for finding the new governor general. And sadly, and it may, you know, drop some monocles and martini glasses to admit this, but maybe not all the things Stephen Harper did were bad.
What? Yeah, you need due process, and there has always, I don't know the mechanics of it, but there has always been a process for this job, but the picks were usually, as I've mentioned before, patronage appointments, not directly. It was, I think they would search for a candidate that was liked politically, that they figured could handle the job, that knew something about the job, and usually came from the ranks of politicians. I mean, if you go far enough back into colonial Canada, let's say, from when it was a French colony, it was usually military people or political types or lords and barons, people with money, that sort of thing. It's only been in the 21st century, really, that we've had governors general that were not necessarily, they're extra political, just kind of from, maybe traveled in the political sphere. I'm thinking journalists like Adrian Clarkson, who would have spoken to a lot of politicians and probably knew the mechanics of what was going on. And was David Johnson was a academic, right? But a well-respected academic, and I think in the legal realm. So they had some inkling probably of how this should work. And I don't know if they hand you a manual necessarily when you walk in there. I'm sure that the 90 staff, or it's quite a large department, that the staff would, there would be some sort of transition for you to, here's what you have to do, and you know, you probably have to talk to the Queen more than most, right? The Queen's representative. But anybody who's seen The Crown knows that, well, it's not just The Crown, but there is a certain way, I think, to be the Governor General, and Julie Payette was not even remotely within the range. And in doing the research for this, the National Post pretty much called this, and it's a paper I never read, in 2018, talking about, you know, well, she's a very smart woman and an engineer and an astronaut, but is she, and they just asked this open question years ago, you know, is she really suited for this job? And their suspicions were probably correct, because it turns out that she wasn't.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily credit any kind of insight into the National Post, because it was a Trudeau appointment, and anything Trudeau does is immediately sketchy, because, you know, liberal. But I mean, the warning signs were there. Like I said, the stuff about what happened at the Montreal Science Center, the fact that she was involved in a hit. And I don't know if she ran, but there was definitely a hit in 2011. And then it sounds like maybe she tried to run over her ex-husband at some point, like a couple of months after that. Oh. Like, she definitely has issues with cars and and other people who get in front of her car. And again, that was in 2011. So, you know, the blinking red light was flashing somewhere. And I think that for Trudeau, the appointment he was going down the check boxes, like, okay, we're appointing a woman. Great. We're appointing a scientist. Great. We're appointing, you know, an astronaut, someone who's, you know, made her life about science and she's accomplished. And there were certain checked boxes they were trying to go down, and they didn't get to the ones like, is this person milquetoast enough to not rock the boat? To just basically like wear the ribbons, be directed to where they have to be by the social staff, and like maybe do an interview occasionally. It's as you were kind of getting at, it's not hard to be the governor general. Any position like that where there's a lot of eyes on you is hard in a lot of ways. But I mean, this is also a position that's just all about tradition and about just, you know, sort of going where you're told and following the traditions that you have, like the stuff set out in, you know, the English court in the 16th and 17th century. It's, you know, it's a well-oiled machine at this point. And she just didn't, she fit one machine, which is the Trudeau checklist, but she didn't necessarily fit the other machine, which is like she wasn't milquetoast enough for the position, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a rubber stamping gig, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of ceremony and pomp, and you need to be ready and prepared for that. But I was thinking back to when she went off message with the throne speech, and Trudeau's face was a study. Mm. It was amazing. She was sort of pulling the like, what's she talking about? But yeah, in this case, they went for whatever means they used to evaluate her. They went full on with the star power aspect of it, which, and no pun intended, really, I guess, which can be problematic, obviously, as proven with this. I thought it was interesting that immediately people were floating Chris Hadfield as a replacement, who is also an astronaut, but he is, who do you put in this high profile in this position that represents Canada, but yet isn't necessarily political? Chris Hadfield. But I happen to... I didn't meet Chris Hadfield, but I was one of the people behind the scenes at a trade show many, many moons ago when I worked in IT. And he seemed like the kind of guy, he was an absolute gentleman, as I would say to people, like right down to the staff that were serving the coffees, right? That's like, this guy seemed like a genuine guy. You would get that within 5-10 minutes. I'm not sure if they had anything anecdotal on Julie Payette. Like, did they not only not go to the former employers, but because I remember a story years ago that the cosmonauts on the space lab had a real problem with Julie Payette, right? I don't know why that stuck with me and I can't find it. So I don't think I'm quoting out of turn though, because it's very vivid. It was like, man, they really don't like this astronaut, right? You don't hear the same thing about Roberta Bonda, right? We have our, you know, our legion of astronauts, I guess. There's not that many. There's like 12 or 13. 14?
No.
14 astronauts? Yeah. So, but it's...
Yeah.
Is that necessarily the field you want to choose from? You could, but there are tons, like tons and tons and tons of well-positioned Canadians that could do this job. So, like, what was the straw poll? Was in the, you know, Today does those polls, and they had 12 names there. I was like, yeah, probably most of these people. Who was on the news the other night? Margaret Atwood. I'm like, yeah, just give it to Margaret Atwood for a couple of years, right? And then and then move on. But they probably don't want to install somebody for a couple of years. It's long view, right? They need to be for a longer period than just a fill-in, right?
Right. And I don't think they want to, I mean, even Margaret Atwood, who is, you know, Ontario, Canada literary royalty, I feel would be a kind of a lightning rod given some of the comments she's made over the years. They're going to go with the most boringest person as possible.
Are you boring? Please be our governor general. Yeah.
Like, I don't know who that would be, or, you know, someone kind of just, everyone can get behind I kind of half expect it to end up being Megan Follows, because who could unite the country in this difficult time more than Anne of Green Gables, the original Anne of Green Gables? I feel like that's kind of the direction we might end up going in. Or even which one survived from Sharon Lois and Bram? It's Lois, isn't it? Lois is still with us.
I believe so. Your picks. Who's next? Pokeroo. Just get Pokeroo to do it.
Pokeroo would be solid. I mean, you know, he's not going to say anything except Pokeroo. So you could probably skate pretty good as like a placeholder governor general. I think some of the pictures with the queen might look a little goofy, but I mean, that's okay. She's 90 something. So she might have a sense of humor about it.
I think we fulfilled our CanCon compliment right there. Like within those 2 minutes there, it's like we went whole hog Canadian. So,
well, I was thinking like my last two picks would either be like Raffi or Fred Penner. I think, you know, those are probably the solid, like if you want name picks who, you know, are not going to, you know, burn the country down.
Did you
even in effigy?
You only got the CBC and TVO growing up. You didn't say, well, like I'm, Commander Tom. Like, you can't be Commander Tom. He's from, yeah.
Well, I, you know, Commander Tom. Oh, maybe Commander Tom.
I can picture the emails now as he'd be like, you're not taking this seriously enough. I was like, well, we took it seriously for 12 minutes.
I think we should definitely submit some sort of formal presentation to Lloyd about it. Lloyd Longfield, RMP, for people who may not know him as well as we do.
Yeah, absolutely. The next time next time he comes on, you'll have to, well, by that time, it may be somebody else or maybe not. I'm not sure how long they can run with the interim, the judge, right? The judge. You know that judge guy. Just get him to
the Chief Justice of the
Chief
Supreme
Justice
Court.
Of the Supreme Court. So speaking of judges and judgment and not really, let's turn to the South, which is mostly the South, although there are QAnon followers in Canada, famously. So we've gotten past the inauguration. We've gotten past the Capitol invasion. I thought it was interesting that the Joe Biden inauguration was just a few minutes early. Just a couple minutes early, because was it not the QAnon plan that at exactly noon when Biden was sworn in, then Trump was going to do something? And I've only been following the QAnon, what they actually believe, kind of passively. It's just this, that, and the other thing. But there was this, the great plan was supposed to happen. And then when it didn't, on Inauguration Day, on January 20th, everything just kind of fell away for a lot of QAnon supporters. It sounds like there are a ton of diehards that will go to the ends of the earth to follow this. But are they falling away now from this belief, Adam? And where will they go would probably be the great question.
Well, I saw Ben Collins of NBC News, who's done a lot of this reporting. He said, you know, the danger now isn't that, or not that it would be a danger if the QAnon people are sort of like wake up and see the light. But the danger now is that they're going to, if the Q mythology doesn't persist, they're going to end up being siphoned off into other equally dangerous areas like white supremacy. Not that some of them aren't already, you know, kind of openly white supremacist or anti-Semitic, but you know, that's where they're going to end up going, because at the end of the day, what they'll have in common with like neo-Nazis or, you know, Oath Keepers or Proud Boys or whoever is that they all hate the same people. So because they all hate the same people, you know, the enemy of my enemy, I guess, you know, in this instance. So that's kind of the real outline danger. The real question, though, is, you know, as you said, you know, where is, I guess, the limit of belief? And to address something, I'm pretty sure that they always have the president take the oath like right before noon, because technically noon is like the demarcation point. The new administration officially starts at noon, so the president takes the oath kind of right before noon. Mm-hmm. So, but the plan was, and there was a lot of evidence to back up that this was what QAnon people believed, and they were buying ham radios and things, because the quote-unquote plan was that Joe Biden would get up to take the oath, it would all go to black, SEAL Team 6 would, you know, run the dais and start arresting people. The internet would go dark, TV would go dark. So the only way you'd be able to communicate is like ham radio and these walkie talkies and things. And then when everything came back up, Trump would be president. And that's when the trials would begin of all the satanic pedophiles and everything. I mean, it's just it's as ludicrous as it sounds, but there are a couple of things happening now. Number one is the explanation that Donald Trump is still in charge, and everything you are seeing with Joe Biden signing executive orders and things is basically an elaborate stage play. Number two is, and I heard a couple of, you know, QAnon influencers say this, that Joe Biden had to be sworn in because that's the how we get the charge of treason, because he has to be caught in the act of sedition before he can be charged with sedition or something along those lines. And then three is the people. And there was some reporting about one of these Telegram channels that have attracted QAnon people since they've been all but thrown off social media, that half of them were just giving up and just saying, well, we've been duped. And those are the people who may end up in other places. But I mean, those people are in sort of a delicate place right now between, you know, whether or not they come out of the cult and come out of the coma, the Q coma, the quoma, or the whether or not they they find their way to other places, I guess.
I don't know if you saw it, but there was an interesting story in the New York Times about somebody who had who followed the QAnon people, like kind of embedded himself. I guess it isn't hard to sign up and you can lurk there. It seems they were communicating quite a bit online by recording themselves, which to me seemed like an interesting workaround, like rather than they were sharing, I'm not even sure where it was, sort of small recordings of them saying, expounding on their theory or idea of what was going to happen and why certain things didn't happen. He described it as this there's several spheres of followers, the people in the core who post the most, and it sounds like it's their entire life. They do nothing else. Then there's the kind of a ring surrounding them, which would involve probably some of the people that were involved in the insurrection and a lot of the hardcore followers. And then there's just this mass around the outside who is, it's quite possibly just people like him and like others who kind of follow QAnon like they followed. I don't know why, I didn't really watch Lost, but it reminds me of that. Because when people would talk about Lost, I'm like, I'm really lost to what you're talking about. Like, this means this and this means that. There would be lots of info out there, like looking for clues and how to untangle things like a great puzzle. I did see one report or one statement that somebody said, you know, this might be the actual greatest troll of all time, the most epic troll, but also the most, possibly one of the most dangerous, right? Because now that this thing seems to be falling away, who is waiting in the wings? You know, is it the Proud Boys? Is it, it sounds like they have their own set of problems right now, but Proud Boys or ISIS or... I was thinking back to the Heaven's Gate cult. Do you remember any of that? Like the what was it? The spaceship was behind Comet Hale-Bopp. And yeah, it was the mass suicide. But that was a very early... I think it was on like BBS and old, like ancient, for those of us that remember it, historical internet conspiracy theories, and people got sucked into that. I mean, you could go all the way back to Jim Jones. I see QAnon as something like that. And thankfully for their sake, I mean, if the Capitol insurrection is QAnon coming to a head, then that's probably for the best before it could get a lot worse. And that I guess that's a question. I did see one thing saying that, oh no, because the inauguration day used to be in March, it's actually March. It's kind of like the second coming, right? Is he coming? Has he already been? So I guess they're hanging on to hope that the I was it March 3rd, whatever it was, the original inauguration date will be used as the date for the insurrection to happen. So they've gotten, yes, they're getting one carryover, and if nothing happens on that day, then it's effectively like fizzled.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, what they'll do is they'll move to another thing. And, you know, this used to be the similar thing with like doomsday people, you know, forever it was 2000, you know, January 1st, 2000, that was going to be the end. And then it was like a date in 2005 for some reason. And then there was, you know, the whole 2012 theory. And I mean, the date keeps just getting pushed back. And it reminds me of an end of there's a Parks and Rec episode where there's a doomsday cult in Pawnee that's always, you know, that's always booking one of the parks for like an end of the world celebration. And it gets to the end of the episode, the world doesn't end. And so they're back at the Parks Department booking the park for the next time the world's supposed to end. And it's just kind of that. The dangerous part is, like, no matter what you think about the Heaven's Gate people, or even people who just, you know, believe in ancient aliens or whatever, they're not in power. QAnon is in power now. And we see that with Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is the Georgia congresswoman who has been getting dunked on this week because people have been digging up her old social media posts, including one where she is basically chasing David Hogg, who was a survivor of the Parkland school shooting, down the street, mm-hmm. screaming about Second Amendment rights. And then on top of it all, Kevin McCarthy, who's the leader, the Republican leader of the House, he puts her on a committee, and of all cockamamie things, I kid you not, he puts her on the Education Committee.
Oh.
And, you know, talk about trolls. It's like, I feel like he's trolling everybody. Like, I don't know who the chair of the Education Committee is, but I'm thinking that poor person, like, that's what you're going to have to deal with for the next 2 years, unless this attempt to expel her is successful, which I doubt it will. But it's in the bloodstream now. This isn't like anything like people like Lost fans or anything like that. It's been institutionalized, so you can't really just write it off as like it's crazy, because it's there. You have to deal with it every day, because it's in the form of this person who everybody knew was the crazy QAnon lady, and still ends up in Congress despite everything. And then on top of that, not only is she not sequestered, as the GOP quietly works to find someone to replace her in 2 years, they put her on the freaking Education Committee, where you know she is going to stir stuff up.
Yep, they're definitely on the hill, like behind the scenes on the hill now, not taking a run at it with a giant horn hat on. But who knows what will transpire over the next couple of years in there. And just quickly, the United Conservative Party report that came out this week. Just briefly reading that and the breakdown of that, some of the tone in that was almost Q speak, the great transformation and foreign agents and the McCarthy list. And I was like, wow, they paid a lot of money for this report that QAnon people probably could have written for them for a lot less money. I don't know, but.
I mean, that's also the other danger, too. And I remember my visit at Riverside Park last summer with people who were talking about things that were very much in the Q realm. But the first thing they said to me and Troy Bridgman from Guelph Today was like, oh, we don't believe in Q. But the stuff they were talking about was very Q. So there's an element between the people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who believes in the most cuckoo bananas version of QAnon, and that's the frazzled drip version that I won't get into because it's almost too explicit for 5 o'clock terrestrial radio. But between that and there's the other end where people are like, oh, we know QAnon is toxic, but we're still going to wink and nod to it. We're just not going to use the brand name QAnon. And that and there are people who will virtue signal, I guess, that they are in the club, even though they know they can't openly say they are in the club. So there's some secret handshakes going on, and that may be a symptom of it.
Well, thankfully, we don't have the cuckoo bananas PSA teed up. At least I don't think so. But we do have some teed up. So you're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. As I said, we're going to take a little bit of a break. Breather, listen to a little bit of music, and we will be back in short order. So please stick around. We'll be right back. man, oh man, that was far out. That was Charles Mingus from an album called I Giganti del Jazz. And that's our Royal Cat Records pick of the week. Royal Cat Records, the little big record shop, 21 MacDonnell in beautiful downtown Guelph. Yes, Charles, I don't get your feet tapping, I guess, among other things. I used to kind of study the bass, and somebody said, oh, you have to listen to Charles Mingus. And I was like, oh, there's no way that will ever be me. But there you have it. An Italian pressing. Yeah, I will never host a jazz show, but I really dig that man. It's really crazy. But yeah, jazz aside, Adam, you spoke to one of our friends in other media in town today at some point.
Yes. So Graham McNaughton, who was working with a reporter from the Toronto Star, published an investigative piece about how forced labor exists in the supply chain of a lot of different Canadian companies, including a couple of big Guelph companies. And this is in reference to the situation that's going on in northwestern China right now with the Uyghurs, which are a Muslim minority in China who are, for lack of a better term, basically living in concentration camps and being enslaved. And a lot of that is work being done in factories that are supplying companies in Canada and the United States, and this is the two of us digging into some of those details.
All right, let's get to that now.
So Graham McNaughton, welcome back to Open Sources. Thank you for coming on and joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe without betraying the confidentiality of sources, how did you get onto this story? Where does it begin for you?
I actually don't need to betray any sources on this one. This is just so what happened was that, I've been, we're journalists, so we're all news junkies. And it was in September where I was reading about doing some more in-depth reading on what was happening with the Uyghur people in China. And through that, I found that there was, some sanctions had been placed against some of these companies by the U.S. government. And, just me thinking is like, because they list all these companies there, that have been sanctioned. I'm like, wonder who they were supplying to. Just out of curiosity, look them up, and then so I'm like, okay, there was an Australian think tank back in February last year had tracked some of their supplier, some of the companies that they were supplying down. And I'm like, and it just turned into, well, I wonder how they figured that out. And then eventually came into, well, why don't I see, see if I can find import data, because I'm a big nerd. And it was through that I found out, okay, that data in Canada is not publicly available. But then finding out that the American data is available, I'm like, okay, let's just, out of curiosity, let's look into this. And the first one that I rang through was a company called Shanghong Myling, which is a home appliance maker in Hefei in China. And one of the first names that jumped out that I saw, Danby, was on there. I'm like, okay, there is a story here. But then I went through the data and saw The Brick and Home Depot. And I was like, oh, there's a lot here. And it was around that time that I reached out to a few reporters at the Star that had done work on, issues around China and the Uyghur genocide in China, and ended up connecting with Jeremy Nuttall, who works in the Vancouver bureau for the Star, and turns out he had been wanting to look into something similar. And it was through this we figured out, okay, we now know how we can figure out who these companies are supplying, and just kind of took off from there.
Maybe to rewind a bit to the Uyghurs are a Muslim minority in China who are, for lack of a better word, there is a genocide that is happening. Nothing you could take to court, obviously, but there's more than enough you know, reporting from international human rights watch and groups like that, who are noting that there is a genocide happening there amongst these people. They are being used in forced labor. They are being forced into re-education. They are being sterilized. Pretty much all the worst things that could happen to a group of people is happening right now to these people in China.
Yeah, and the rate at which it's growing is, it's pretty crazy. Because I know at the end of 2020, BuzzFeed News put out a really good feature on what was with these labor camps and, well, what the Chinese call reform centers, mm-hmm. with really heavy quotation marks on that, mm-hmm. Where they actually took satellite images over, you know, the last few years, and you could just see the rate at which these places were growing, and with a lot of them having factories built into the camps. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be where it's heading, is that rather than, you know, taking Uyghur people out of Xinjiang and sending them to factories in other parts of China, the factories are just being built in Xinjiang next to these camps, or mm-hmm. as part of the camps, and that's where looks like they may be getting sent.
Right, and that seems to be part of the issue, is that it is open season on the Uyghurs, and because of that, it's now become business. It's literally become a business that, you know, this town of, you know, 200,000 people is now one of the most major manufacturing centers, because basically that's where the slave labor is.
Yeah.
I want to get to sort of the reaction on the other side here, because you did talk to Jim Estill, who's the head of Danby. There were a couple other businesses who were quoted in the article too. But let me look at it from the governmental side of this first, which is, these companies you were looking at are on a list of sanctioned companies in the United States. But the way you kind of phrased it in the article is that we don't have sanctions on these companies here in Canada. We just have sort of Justin Trudeau said, like, strongly suggesting you don't do business with these companies. That's the long and the short of this, right?
Yeah, exactly. Global Affairs Canada has taken a little bit more of a turn in the last week. Let's say, what day is it today? 20? Yeah, in the last week or so. So it would be, you know, January 21st when they issued a release saying that they're going to be pushing for more, I guess, sort of accountability on the company's ends if they're doing business in Xinjiang, and whether it be just doing business there or importing goods that are made there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is like just like signing a declaration to say that there was no forced labor, and like there's not, the penalties on if you don't follow it are pretty minimal. It's, well, if you don't follow this, then you don't get you don't qualify for certain incentives from the Canadian government. Mm. Which, if you're a multi-billion dollar international company, okay, fine. That, like, that's not a big issue for someone like that. It could, you know, it could be a major disincentive for smaller businesses that are maybe doing business in Xinjiang, perhaps legitimately just doing business there. Mm. But for a big multinational, you know, it's a drop in the bucket.
Right. And they're already seeing substantial benefits basically having their stuff made by slave labor anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a debate that's been going on for decades. You know, like two of the companies that were named in the story, Nike and Gap, have been at the center of sweatshop labor debates, you know, going back to the 80s and 90s. Like, this is nothing new for companies like that. Mm-hmm. Although I guess where the story may gets a little bit different is that it goes outside of the, I guess, sort of what you might call the stereotypical ideas of forced labor or sweatshop labor. We're getting into home appliances, we're getting into parts for trains. Mm. Which, you know, was something that was, you know, I wasn't expecting to come across, but here we are.
Yeah, we're used to the idea of your shoes being made by slavery, unfortunately. We're getting used to the idea. The companies you talk to, and I believe there was a comment from not only Jim Estill but from the BRIC as well, and they're pointing to their own internal investigations. It seems like it is pretty much, you know, established that if you have a factory in this area of China, you are using slave labor. And that's because that's the only reason you're there. It's like the northwestern part of the country. Are these people, and I don't want to throw around aspersions, but are they maybe deluding themselves a bit? Or is it like, because I did note that the one MP you quoted in the article, Jim McKay, said that the, or somebody in the article anyway, said that, you know, the third party reviews that these companies do don't necessarily get the job done. It's a good sort of PR measure, like, oh, we have third party oversight, but it's not particularly effective because of, you know, the companies get advance notice when they're coming. They spend maybe a day there. Is it a matter of, I guess, to come back to the question, people turning a blind eye and being like sort of willfully ignorant, or do they generally have faith in a system that is letting them down?
That's a good question. Well, as far as like the third party audits, Global Affairs Canada, with their release on the 21st about doing business in Xinjiang, they, like, Global Affairs Canada even said themselves that, yeah, third part, you know, these third party audits, it's an important part of your due diligence, but do not rely on them solely as your due diligence. And whether that be, you know, having your own staff do audits, or in the Global Affairs Canada also recommends, like, maybe you really should connect with, you know, these non-governmental organizations that specialize in supply chain and forced labor and all that, because they'll know what to look for. Mm. It's their specialty. And the one person that I interviewed in the story, Dr. Andrew Crane, he's an advisor to the Home Office in the UK on supply chain. And he had said that, you know, like, these audits are, they're not sufficient. A lot of times, as you mentioned, you know, they're in and out in a day. Factories will have an idea that they're coming, so you can easily just sort of like, all right, for that one day, if you have people that are there that shouldn't be, you can, you know, take them off the floor for the day. Right. And he had said, you know, like, these visits need to be unannounced, take place over multiple days, and you should be able to take the workers out of the factory to interview them, because a lot of these workers will be coached on, all right, if an auditor comes and they ask you these questions, here's what you say. And if you have, you know, the watchful eye of your boss looking over you the whole time that you're talking to the auditor, you can't be honest, because it's like, if I am honest, am I going to get fired? Or with it, you know, in China, you know, could it even be worse than just getting fired?
Right.
And there was one thing that didn't make it into the story, unfortunately, just because, well, we were already at 3,000 words, so we were running out of room. But the one thing that Crane said that I thought was interesting was that audits, as they exist now, don't take into account how forced labor typically works, which is that they're not there permanently. These people will be in for shorter periods of time, whether it be, you know, like to fill like a big order, for example. You'll get sent in to do that, and then once the order, you know, that big order is filled or that backlog is cleared, they're gone. They're sent somewhere else. So, you know, if there's not an audit done during that time, the audit's not going to catch it. And I know the one thing that, you know, we hear a lot about with the COVID-19 stuff, especially if you've gotten tested, you'll hear this is a snapshot in time. Those audits are the same thing. It's what was it like on the day that the audit happened. So just because an audit says we did not observe any evidence of forced labor on that day does not mean it has never happened there.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of like an old news clip I saw of Congressman Leo Ryan visiting Jonestown the day before the massacre, and getting up in front of the people of Jonestown saying, well, it seems everybody's told me this is the greatest place they've ever been. And then later that night, it starts to fall apart when people come up to him and say, no, we have to get out of here because Jim Jones is nuts. Sometimes the problem doesn't present itself until the very last minute. This is an important piece of that, too, that you brought up, that it's in the interest of companies to say that we do not have forced labor or slave labor in the supply chain. And so when you when you're talking about these third-party systems, and that point from Dr. Crane, I think, is really important, that this idea that these people aren't on the factory floor for years. You know, they come in and they go out. It would be very easy for someone at one of these factories to say, oh, you're coming to do a third-party audit next week when we have all this slave labor on the factory floor. We're kind of filling a big order this week. Why don't you come next week, and then we'll be able to really spend some time with you. And of course, by that point, all the forced labor is moved out, like you said. It's like the loophole is really that simple, or that obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. It's easy enough to work around with how these audits work.
Another thing I did note from Dr. Crane in the article is that he said any multinational company will have forced labor in the supply chain somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that presents like such a bigger problem than just the Youngers, because they're not the only forced labor in the world. There's no slave trade anymore, but there is still slavery in the world.
Exactly. CBC Marketplace did a really good story. I think it was about a week and a half ago now, so mid-January, and they were looking at PPE manufacturers in Malaysia. And you have it's a different type of slave labor, or forced labor rather, where you've had people that have paid to get these jobs in Malaysia and coming in from Nepal and Bangladesh. You know, these poorer countries, and if I can scrape together enough money, get this job, I can help my family back home. But then they get there and their passports are confiscated. They're, forced overtime. You're working weeks on end with no days off. You're not getting paid what you said, what they told you you were going to get paid. So it's an issue. It's bigger than China. You could argue that a lot of it just comes down to people wanting to buy products as cheaply as possible, or companies trying to get as big a margin on their products as possible, or a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. And it's when you get into things like that is where systems like this really start to propagate.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned before the difficulty in getting a hold of these the Canadian shipping records, and a lot of the research you did is based on cargo going into the U.S. that is earmarked for being coming to Canada through other means. That seems like kind of a big problem to me, not just generally this issue, but it's one of these sort of areas where the U.S. is a little bit far ahead of us with the disclosure. So just to clarify, is it that it's really hard to get these shipping records, or is it just like you cannot get these shipping records? They are just not public at all. It's not a matter of they're filling out a ton of forms or anything.
They are not. Yeah. In Canada, they are not public. Mm-hmm. Under law, I can't remember the name of the act right off the top of my head, but there are very limited circumstances under which you can get those records. And a lot of it comes down to, if someone is... there's harm being caused to someone that these records would help unearth, then they could be made public. But even then, you're looking at individual shipments, as opposed to in the U.S. With the software that they used, we can type in, who is supplying Nike? Mm. Type in Nike, and we get all the shipments that are coming in to the U.S., whether they stay in the U.S. or go up to Canada, and say that are earmarked for Nike. And we can tell you where they came from, what ship they were on, how much is coming in, tons of information. And sometimes you can actually see the individual items that are in the order. Like for the brick, we knew that it was their house line of fridges, because the serial numbers were in the ship in the bills of lading. So you can mm-hmm. see, it's X number of this model number, and you just look up the model number and you know what you're looking at.
I mentioned this because that would be a good first step, is having access to this information and sort of being able to draw a direct line from these factories in China. to businesses that are doing business and selling these goods here in Canada, to in order to make, because I know, again, MP McKay is trying to get legislation through, but that's a little hard when you don't understand the full scope of the problem. And getting to see the shipping records would be a pretty good way of drawing that picture for the public.
Absolutely, because, well, and I know we mentioned this in the story, this is likely the tip of the iceberg. Like, we've picked out a few hundred shipments total over the last couple of years, you know, and how many billions of dollars of goods come straight into Canada. Like, if you go to any, you know, any dock, you know, any shipping dock in Canada, whether it be out in Vancouver or even when I used to, like when I used to live in Oshawa, there's a dock there as well. And you see these massive shipping, you know, shipping tankers come in with thousands of containers. And so it's like, well, where are they coming from? And if you're wanting to root out, you know, instances of forced labor, how can, you know, how can there be oversight if we don't know where this stuff is coming from? Like, I'm, you know, the government will know where it's coming from. They have access to that information, but the general public doesn't. So there's no oversight as to where the stuff is coming from.
Do you have a sense that there is a growing public appetite to deal with this directly? Like, even not to say that one story can change the world, but I mean, even just reaction to your story, even here in Guelph, you know, is, you know, have people maybe, not that we didn't already know, given everything we talked about with Nike and everything, but I mean, is there a growing awareness that there needs to be public pressure here in order, if we're going to actually achieve any kind of change on this issue?
There's definitely been a lot of people that have reached out and just said, like, I had no idea, like, you know, like, as we talked about, you know, like when you talk about clothing and shoes, you know, that's sort of in the back of your mind that that's going to be a problem. But when you look at, you know, like the fridge in your house, like there's a fridge in every house. And it's like, this is something that's in every home. And it's like, wait, hold on. Like, this is something, you know, like we, you know, scrape together, you know, especially sometimes, you know, you really need to scrape together to get some money to buy a new fridge. And it's like, did I unknowingly help out someone who's using, you know, forced labor or slave labor, depending on where it's coming from? I think people really don't have a good idea necessarily. And I probably don't either, because I don't have all the information of like how many things that we use every day that the only reason we have it is because someone was forced to make it against their will. You know, they don't want to be there. They just want to be at home, but instead they're forced to work in these factories. Like, I know with the sanctions list, when you go through it, like the American sanctions list and some of these companies that are on there, because there were some companies in there that we did searches through and didn't find any Canadian subsidiaries, but you're looking at, you know, you're looking at computers, you're looking at your cell phone. And then of course, home appliances, parts for trains. It's a, you know, massive swath of the economy and things that, you know, people are buying on either, you know, big one-time purchases or, you know, they're purchasing on a regular basis. So yeah. I really hope that there's a bigger push to be like, we really need a better idea of where the things that we're buying, where they're coming from.
You can find ethically sourced t-shirts, but you can't find ethically sourced fridges.
Yeah, exactly. You're not gonna find a fridge with a fair trade label on it.
That's right. Well, Graham, great work on this, I found the article fascinating, and I'm glad we were able to take a bit of a deeper dive with you on it. So thanks for joining me.
And thanks for having me. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff with you.
And that was Adam speaking to Graham McNaughton of our local Guelph Mercury Tribune. And I think I actually read that in the Star. If you're looking for that article somewhere, you can Google, "Was your fridge made with forced labor?" and it should it should come up somewhere. So yeah, deep dive indeed, Adam. It's good to hear that kind of reporting still going on, and reminded me of the old sounded like it could have been an episode of The Working Week for those of you that remember that. But I have to remember we are out of time, like completely out of time. So Adam, if people were looking to find out more about you and what you do, where can they do that?
Well, I would just add too that Graham told me off air to stay tuned because there is still more to come on that story. Oh. So you can find me on Guelph Politico, guelphpolitico.ca, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson as well.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find us every Thursday here at 5 o'clock on CFRU 93.3 FM. And check out our website at cfru.ca. Always lots going on there. So thanks for joining us this week, and stay tuned for Sounds Good to Me. Take care, folks, and have a good week.